The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Representative Schoen, you're up first if you're ready.
I'm getting there. I'm looking for my bill in the packet. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before you is with House File 814 is related to...
Wait one second, Representative Schoen. Representative Schoen, you're going to move House File 814 to pass this committee and go to the General Register.
Yes,
that's
sir.
The motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So this deals with just a small change, which is actually a pretty significant change for local communities related to reporting of a hazardous substance or extremely hazardous substance release, spill, or otherwise. What this comes out of is down in St. Paul Park in my area, we have a oil refinery, and occasionally we'll get an email report maybe 3-4 days later where the refinery called the state duty officer and had a 500-pound release of XYZ, and there was no notification to the local authorities. You know, you'll hear sirens go off down at the refinery, and everybody wonders what's going on, and it's about a communication issue. I will dispense with my further description at this point, and I do have a couple testifiers. Have the Honorable Mayor of St. Paul Park, Keith Franke. He come up and give his quick response to the need for this as well.
Mr. Mayor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, members.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Keith Franke, Mayor of St. Paul Park. I am here today in support of the proposed change to House File 814. St. Paul Park is a community that is home to one of Minnesota's few oil refineries. We in St. Paul Park feel that the proposed change of House File 814 would allow for better preparedness by our public safety departments. Earlier and quicker notification allows us for faster informed decisions when it comes to the safety of our citizens and the refinery employees. It would also allow our department chiefs to make real-time decisions and choices with regards to a response or non-response, depending upon the report that's being made at that time. The current system at present allows that sometimes our chiefs do not receive the information until days later. To me and our staff, this is not acceptable, so we ask for your help and support in these changes. Unfortunately, today our department chiefs were unable to make it, so I'm here to answer any questions that you may have to the best of my ability, and I would like to thank you for your time and your support in this matter.
Hey, Mr. Are there any questions of the mayor? Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair, maybe a question of Representative Schoen, too. As far as the reporting goes, I really don't have any problem with this bill. When we're talking about reporting to a local authority like the fire or police, is a 911 call adequate for that, or what is the, or are you calling directly to the St. Paul Park Fire Department or something like that?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schoen, I'm sorry.
Representative Uglum, you know, quite frankly, that may vary. And so Duluth Fire is career. St. Paul Park Fire is part-time, but we have at least an officer on duty 24 hours a day, a police officer. And so some of this has to do with just making sure someone knows. And so if there's a number that they can establish in Duluth or Minneapolis or St. Paul to call right into their communication center, or, for instance, in the city of Champlin, they would maybe call into Hennepin. Is that right? Which county? I'm sorry. What your county seat, whoever handles your 911. And again, call the non-emergency number, whatever the established guidelines would be, and just call and say we need either a call back from the officer just to let them know that this is what happened, and we don't think it's an emergency, but we just need to make sure that someone's informed about it. So we don't need anybody at the scene, but we just need to let the local jurisdiction know.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, we always encourage in our city to call 911. And some of the smaller towns and everything else, which don't have staffed 24 hours a day, I'm hoping that the 911 call would be adequate to eliminate the $50,000 fine or whatever.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ugleman, that is certainly is our intent, that we're not necessarily trying to create a guideline that this would require a response. And I think and I think I should have the fire chief that's going to testify and give some information, and maybe might help clarify that as well too, of what we can do and some of the how this can be handled, and then I can clarify at the end if you still have more questions.
Very good.
But that would be my intent, Representative Ugleman, is if someone did call the local sheriff's department, if you're out in rural Minnesota or Isanti County, that would be good for the night, and say that we don't need a fire department response, and the local sheriff's department, if they're the law enforcement group that handles those responses, they can determine whether they need to go further.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, just a couple quick issues here. One of them, you have up to a $2,500 fine and imprisonment up to 2 years in both, but if you're possibly putting somebody in prison, have you even requested a fiscal note yet?
Mr. Schoen, I understand there's no cost to this, but I, Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair and members, a fiscal note is requested when it is expected to create costs incurred by the state. This is creating an obligation to someone with a spill to report to the local police department and or fire department, and I didn't see any costs that the state would incur from this bill.
Mr. Wells, I don't know, but I suspect, Representative Anderson, if there were a lot of violations, this could have a local criminal justice impact. If there's, what is the misdemeanor?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
A violation would be a misdemeanor, I would suspect.
They would be a felony.
It's felony. So,
Mr. Chair, I seem to have missed that. I can put in a request for a fiscal note. Generally, on bills of this type, where there isn't where there isn't presumed to be a large criminal impact or cases of less than say one or two per year, they generally come back as zero.
Just to be on the safe side, Representative Anderson, I think your point well taken. Why don't we, Johnson, Representative Johnson, maybe we should request further information. I suspect it's going to come back zero, but let's find out.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Schoen,
just to clarify, this isn't creating a whole new statute with a whole new set of crime. It's just an addition to the already record. They already have to report to the duty officer and other agencies, but this is just adding, say, hey, you got to get also call your local agencies.
Representative Johnson.
And the other part of this, you stated that you have a man, somebody at your station 24 hours a day, and I would suspect probably 99% of the fire departments in this state do not have they're all volunteer, and they don't have people at their office. Generally, if you want a fire department, you call 911. If you would call the city hall, they'd have to call somebody else and try to find them, because they're volunteers, they're probably working. The state duty officer requirement now, and I've actually been in our dispatch center when they have called us about a situation that they feel that emergency response is needed. If emergency response is not needed, they don't call. But we do usually get the information within 12 hours of the spill. And that's faxed to us daily. I see those reports, or I used to see those reports daily every time. I think this is just adding things that are unneeded at this time.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
And Representative Johnson, I appreciate your input. That certainly hasn't been the case across the state and in other jurisdictions. And your point about staffing, I think that touched on exactly the conversation Representative Uglem and I just had, was that the local PSAF would be sufficient, because yes, if you're out in Clare City, Minnesota, where I grew up, you don't, there isn't, it's volunteer fire department. And then there may be an officer on duty or on call, or at least there's the sheriff's deputy that's on duty, and at least someone made a contact. And no, that doesn't necessarily mean that the fire department needs to respond, but that local jurisdiction needs to know that there was something that did happen, and this is what's been important to us. So that's all I'm trying to get at, is that we're not trying to wake people up at 2 in the morning for every little thing that happens, because that's not the case. But this is a different circumstance. So if with that, I would like to turn it over. He could give you some clarification on an issue that was very important as well.
Wait, one second. Representative Uglem has a question first, and then we'll have the chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question of the author here. When we're looking at this bill and we're looking at these fines and imprisonment terms and everything else, I think one of the things that we should look at a little bit is there are significant differences in the definition and the substances between hazard and extremely hazardous. And I'm all for some very, very stiff fines and things for the extremely hazardous substances. But if you look at the list of substances that are defined as hazardous under the U.S. Code and everything else, there are some products that I'd hate to go to jail for 5 years for a spill. So, I mean, that's something that while we're looking at this, we should maybe take a look at in terms of the fines and things. Because extremely hazardous substances, I think, certainly merit a second time around. And like my colleague, Representative Neuberger, says, we don't want to see fire and police personnel injured and things like that. But certain hazardous substances, they are classed that way, but in many cases, they're not nearly as bad. So it's something that maybe we could take a look at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglem, I hear what you're saying. I'm not a scientist or a chemist, and these are you know, I'm not defining anything that's already been long defined,
right,
when this bill was placed. So that's not the area I'm wanting to venture in, and if somebody else wants to and you want to, then Godspeed.
Your next testifier, then.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ken Prilliman. I'm the fire chief and the emergency management director for the city of Brooklyn Park.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. It's an honor to be here, and I represent the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota State Fire Department Association, and want to comment on a few issues that have been raised this morning. First of all, with regard to the bill, we believe that the bill closes a significant gap in public safety today. Current statute does require that businesses who have a hazardous release contact state duty officer. However, sir, the current mandate for the state duty officer does not require them to notify local jurisdictions. Emergency events of all types begin and end in the local jurisdiction, with us having responsibility to respond and mitigate. The notification language that's contained in here on behalf of the state associations that I represent, we're not calling for an onerous notification process. We are specifically calling for simply 911. The 911 centers in this state by statute are managed by the sheriffs, and there are existing protocols within each county for how public safety responds to a variety of very specific events. So the way in which Hennepin County dispatches my fire department for hazardous material is an agreement through which the Hennepin fire chiefs and the sheriff came to with regard to how many resources, what types of resources, how many stations they page, etc. And that system would work well throughout the entire state. So a simple 911 would satisfy our requirement for notification and would allow local counties then to work with their public safety responders in terms of what kind of response is going to take place. I'd like to remind the committee that, and no pun intended, but hazardous materials are called hazardous for a reason. They're hazardous. And it's a very, very broad definition. By classification, gasoline is a hazardous material, but if I brought a cup of it in here, we wouldn't be in much danger. If I brought 500 gallons of it in here and spilled it, that very same material outside of its container would be very dangerous. Brooklyn Park experienced an anhydrous ammonia leak, which is highly toxic, respiratory, invasive chemical, and we're not notified. Local jurisdiction was not notified for over 6 hours. Fortunately, this leak ended up being a pinhole leak in an air conditioning unit on a rooftop air conditioning piece of equipment. That could have been very, very different. We saw firsthand an anhydrous ammonia factory get hit in Wadena, and we saw the immediate, within minutes, impact to that community of having that type of release. Many of these chemicals, we don't have 24 hours or 12 hours or 6 hours. Some of these chemicals outside of their container react very poorly to air, very poorly to water. A release of some of these chemicals on a rainy day is a significantly different event than a release of some of these chemicals on a mild, calm, sunny day. So the language is important for us to be notified as first responders so that we can do the job that we are mandated to do, respond to the scene, and to do an assessment. Firefighters in this state, under the state-adopted and certified Firefighter One curriculum, include curriculum and certification as hazardous material at the operations level. This allows all of our first responders to be able to identify and assess the magnitude of these releases in order to determine the appropriate level of response. This bill closes this very significant gap today in us being allowed to assess and mitigate these types of emergencies. And it's unfortunately not as simple as drawing some line in the sand over quantity or certain chemical types. I have a plating company in Brooklyn Park that operates day-to-day with a documented 380 chemicals on site. Each one of those is going to react differently to various different situations, and when you begin to combine those together, it compounds the overall effect. So we believe strongly that this bill is important, this change to this bill is important. We support it, and we would ask the committee to do the same. And I'll be glad to take any questions.
Very good. Any questions? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schoen, for bringing this forward. I too, echo your sentiments. As you see, I have an amendment to this that will move, hopefully, soon. And I agree with you in this area, in this regard. Wow.
That's new.
Anyway, I just the whole issue of hazardous materials and hazardous responses is one that needs to be addressed in this fashion. I think this begins to do so. I want to echo. I've been on hazardous material response calls in the past. Some of these areas, when you think industrial threats, they're true, they're real, they can be, but some of the most dangerous areas are for hazardous materials can be right next door. Dry cleaners deal with hazardous materials. The local swimming pools, especially indoors, with the amount of chlorine that they use. I had a mass casualty incident one time at a small hotel because somebody poured way too much chlorine into a pool, and had it been more than it should have been, we could have had a lot of dead swimmers because the person taking care of the water didn't know what they were doing. So I do applaud this, and I will also say that what the fire chief said is absolutely true when it comes to weather factors. About 20 years ago, one of the very first hazardous materials responses that I went to was a train spill. We had a train car. It was a tanker car. It was out in western Hennepin County, out by the edge. It was an anhydrous tank, big, huge train car, and thank God that the temperature was about 30 degrees, because it kept it from vaporizing. It was the temperature, the ambient air temperature, and there was no discernible wind, and they were able to clean that spill up. Had it been warmer out, that we could have been looking at thousands of deaths. It was just a weather factor. So the police chief is absolutely correct in this here assessment. So I want to thank you for bringing that forward, and I want to echo what you're saying here.
Ms. Neuberger, you still want to offer your amendment? We'll wait till after all the testimony.
But yeah, that's fine. I'll leave it to your discretion.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen. Overall, I like the idea of this bill. I think some notification needs to be done. I'm just wondering if we should, instead of just somewhat piecemealing it with the fire department or the sheriff's office or the local jurisdiction, would be much better to require these spills be notified to the duty officer immediately and require the duty officer to make the phone calls if he deems necessary for immediate action. That way it's getting down to just one phone call instead of having to make three or four phone calls for this person.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my initial reaction is I don't have a high level of peacefulness with that. The nature of a state agency now being charged with something that's beyond their current mission, and the need to be able to identify where this is at and who is the appropriate jurisdiction. The advantage of 911 is it routes the local caller to the local 911 center, who has intimate knowledge of where a train track is running or the address is in a certain location. I'm not certain whether or not the state duty officer can identify where a particular plating company is or the authority having jurisdiction over that location easily and be able to route those requests in a timely fashion. I don't know enough about the state duty officer process. Today, there are hazardous material releases that are reported to 911. We have an extensive experience that this works. The businesses that are using that system, the one that we are proposing be mandated, works well on a voluntary basis across the state, where employers recognize the need to get local responders involved and on their own dial 911. And so in those areas and in those examples, that system is the most effective method. Under the proposed suggestion that the state duty officer be involved, we have phone call from the state duty officer to identify the local PSAP who would have the authority, and then we have the process of beginning to page out resources, and in a volunteer department it might be 10 minutes before a response agency could actually get a vehicle rolling. It would seem to me that we could easily lose 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour in that process, where today a call to 911 results in at least that call being dispatched within minutes. So I would respectfully suggest that or offer that as my opinion.
Okay. Representative Neuberger, is there any questions before Representative Neuberger offers his amendment? Do you have anything else to say?
Mr. Chairman, no, sir.
Thank you very much. For your testimony. Is there anyone, do you have any other witnesses? Okay. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to title this amendment N1, Neuberger 1. Well, it's not on here, so I figured we had to give it something. All I would like to do, I'd like to move that amendment. All I want to do is insert on line 117 some language that would include local ambulance providers. And this is simply, I've worked in the metro for a very first-rate ambulance service, one of the best for years, but I've also worked in outstate ambulances. There are many times where you are the only responder on the scene. Maybe you might get a deputy sheriff. Sometimes you have to wait for them if they're on a call. I've had multiple times in my history of my EMS career where it's you and one deputy sheriff if you're lucky. If you're out in greater Minnesota, Oftentimes, the ambulance providers are the first ones to arrive on these calls. And all I want to do is just to make sure that we cover all of Minnesota, especially greater Minnesota, and include some type of provision where the local ambulance providers are included in the notification chain. That's all I want to do, is to make sure that they're in on this. There are many local jurisdictions throughout the state where you do not get the fire department on a call unless it's an auto accident where that requires extrication or cleanup. So that's the case. I just, like I said, I want this to be all-encompassing, and I don't want to shortchange our greater Minnesota ambulance providers. So that's the rationale for the language, just to keep them in the information loop as well.
Representative Schoen, reaction to the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger, I like the attention that you're giving to the ambulance providers, because you and I are both paramedics, and we both worked in rural Minnesota, and this actually was something that I thought about as well when you brought it up. I wonder if this is what he's trying to get at. I think we've both been in that situation where we've been called at the last minute when everybody else is there, and they go, oh, crap, where's the ambulance? We forgot to call them. And so I like where you're going. I'm just not sure that it's necessary in this bill. I think that if we talked about guidelines within response and gave suggestions to communities to make sure that when they have to respond to a scene that they should absolutely call and have an ambulance on standby as well, too, to make sure that the medical coverage is taken care of. I just don't know that this is the particular bill to address that type of... I agree with you. So I don't want you to... For one of the odd times, I don't want you to think I'm anti-Neuberger here. This is actually the right direction. I just don't know it's the right avenue to get there for what we want to accomplish as a whole, for making sure EMS is in the loop for all sorts of incidences where people need to have that. And so I guess what I would ask is that if there's a way we could look at in the future in emergency response and work with the Fire Chiefs Association and however it works out, and the MAA and the EMSRB, to make sure that we have guidelines and suggested response protocols for fire departments and those issues. And I know that we've been working on this for a long time at local levels to when they're not integrated. When I mean not integrated, if they have a fire EMS system like St. Paul, it's pretty much automatic. They have it, it's all together. But you may be in, small town, and they don't necessarily get, the dispatcher may not page the ambulance right off the get-go, and we'll want to at some point get that squared away. But I think that's growing. So I guess my preference is here right now. Maybe this isn't the best spot for it. I don't think it's wrong, but I don't know that it's needed, because if you worked for a not-for-profit or one of the non-fire or city-based EMS services such as North or Hennepin County or Health East, that they're exactly the same, because you might get the phone call and then send an ambulance when no one else is sending the ambulance. So okay. Sorry to ramble on about that, Mr. Chair. I guess
you
at this point, I think it's not the spot.
I have a couple comments on the amendment, Representative Hillstrom, or on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I just think that in many instances in the metro area, we have more than one ambulance service, and so do they have to call all of them or one of them? Or I think we should leave that to the 911 or whoever it is that gets called to notify when ambulance is needed.
Is that a question for Representative Neuberger or a
no,
comment?
Just a comment.
Okay. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and specifically to the amendment. And I'm going to agree with Representative Schoen that I agree with your intent here, but I also don't think that this is the right place, for the simple reason that I don't think we want to create a situation where if somebody spills 10 gallons of gasoline that they're required to notify the local ambulance service. For the simple reason that, A, what would you do with that information? B, I don't think you want to hear all those phone calls. C, I don't think we want to penalize the reporting person if they fail to make that call because they didn't think about making that call. Now, that being said, I think that your intent probably is that if you respond to something and there was something there that you would want to know about that and what it was be able to protect your employees in that fashion. But I would have to disagree with the amendment just from the simple fact that I think it's creating a step that is unnecessary and perhaps not in line with the intent of the original bill.
Representative Neuberger, do you still want to offer your amendment?
Yes, I do. I want to answer Representative Hillstrom's concern. In the metro area, these calls are dispatched. They go through generally the sheriff's department, and they get allocated to whoever the ambulance service has jurisdiction over that area. So, if there was a spill, let's say at the Target Center. If there's a spill at the Target Center, then the only agency that they would be required to contact would be Hennepin County, because that's in their jurisdiction, Hennepin County's ambulance. If there was a spill in Brooklyn Park, the only ones that would be contacted would be North Memorial, because that's their ambulance service area. In response to Representative Sean and Simon, I just have to ask the question is, and again, I bring back to this, I understand what you guys are getting at, that the fire services and the dispatch centers are they do an excellent job. I'm not going to argue with that, because you can't. However, there are areas in this state where you don't get, if it's 12 o'clock noon on a Tuesday, it's going to take a long time to get that volunteer fire department to show up to a scene. If you've got the volunteer ambulance showing up, you've got two volunteer two volunteer ambulance personnel that are going to show up to a scene, and they're not going to have potentially the information that they need to keep themselves safe. So my question is what does this bill stand to lose if you exclude ambulance personnel? And with that, I'll just leave it in your good hands.
Okay, very good. So Representative Neuberger, on line 1.17, after the word center, and after the comma, I should say, the center comma, insert local ambulance provider. That's it. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the Neuberger motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? No. The motion does not prevail. Okay, Representative Schoen, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Any last words, Representative Schoen?
Mr. Chair, we beat this up pretty good. Let's move this on to the General Register, and I absolutely look forward to working with Representative Neuberger on this EMS issue as a whole. I think he's on the right track. I absolutely agree with that for what we need to do in the future for EMS, and I appreciate you bringing that up and keeping that on the forefront, because it is an important issue, even though I didn't agree with this in this particular bill.
Representative Hillstrom, do you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you need to see this bill?
No. That's okay. Actually what I wanted to put on the record. I wasn't sure if there was a fiscal note, if it needed to go to Ways and Means or not. But, Mr. Chair, this doesn't create a new felony. It's not asking sentencing guidelines to re-rank anything. It's just, you know, modifying the language. And so I think... we don't need to see it, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I just wanted to point out for Representative Ugleman in under B for the $50,000 fine or imprisonment of 5 years. That's for second or subsequent offenses, so it's repeat offenders. So I just hopefully that helps ease your mind just a touch.
And staff seems to think that this is not going to have a fiscal cost, but if it does, Representative Schoen, then we'll have to pull it from the floor, and you can go through the Ways and Means Committee, which will be a good experience for you. Okay, so having said that, Representative Schoen renews his motion that House File 814 pass and be sent to the General Register. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schoen.
Thank you.
Representative Dean. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. I will move your bill, House File 491, with the recommendation to pass the Public Safety Committee and refer to the Committee on Elections.
I believe so.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair and members, I have a authors delete all amendment, which should be in your packet.
Okay, Representative Dean has the A13-0162 amendment.
That is correct.
To get the bill in the shape that he wants. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? That motion prevails.
Okay, I do have one slight change, if I can add that at this time.
Okay. You have an oral amendment to it?
Oral amendment on line 4.19, delete elections and insert public safety. It's within section 7.
So we're just we'll just incorporate that language into line 419.
Great, thank you.
Okay, Representative Dean, do you want to present your bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 491, if enacted, will allow individuals with felony convictions to vote if they are not incarcerated. The bill is gaining bipartisan support, and I ask you all to support it today. I have two people here today to testify on behalf of the bill. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman and Mark Hossey from the Council on Crime and Justice. And then I would also like to testify directly to the bill after they've spoken.
You want to explain what the bill does, Representative Dean?
Yeah, as I mentioned, it allows an individual who's been convicted of a felony to vote if they are not incarcerated. Current statute allows an individual to vote only after they are off supervision, so after their parole has expired or after they are off probation. And what this does is it really allows individuals, one, to be out in the community and participating as voters, but it also takes care of a lot of the confusion that currently exists. There are many individuals who are out that unfortunately think they can vote while they're under supervision. Several cases of voter fraud are indicated by that, and I believe that County Attorney Freeman will speak to that. And there are even individuals who have long been off of supervision that still think that they cannot vote. So what this does is this streamlines that. It makes it simple that if you're locked up, you can't vote. If you're out, you can vote. It's based on what's considered a North Dakota model, and they've been doing it for many, many years, and it's been very successful for them.
Okay, Representative Dean, your witnesses, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Freeman, the Hennepin County Attorney, and thank you for having me to your
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm also here with County Attorney Paul Bullmaster from Rice County. That's Faribault is the county seat, immediate past president of the County Attorneys Association. This legislation is a priority for your county attorneys who have unanimously endorsed it. House File 491, the A13 Amendment, also has the support of most local election officials, and it had overwhelming support of the governor's task force on election integrity. Frankly and directly speaking, here's the present situation: is a person who is convicted of a felony cannot vote while they're incarcerated and cannot vote when they're out on probation or parole thereafter. And in fact, they can't vote until they're what we call in the business off paper. And the confusion occurs here is lots of times the parole period will extend over a number of years and will only require the individual to report once a year, and they'll be on totally unsupervised release. In essence, society has said, and your corrections divisions have said, that these people don't need to be watched any further, but their period of parole is extended. This causes no end of problems in the election system. Many of the folks on parole don't know they can't vote and go and register and vote anyway. Some of the people, as Representative Dean has said, have come off paper, have been off it 5-10 years, and think they still can't vote. Moreover, it causes a great deal of consternation to elected officials election officials and county attorneys. Let me be precise. Everyone's trying to keep lists and make sure that they're accurately portrayed so folks who shouldn't vote don't vote, including this large group of felons who are on paper. But there is also a statute that requires county attorneys, at the risk of losing their job, that we must investigate, and if there's probable cause, charge them and go through the whole process. Let me give you a specific number. In Hennepin County, in year 2008, 665,000 people voted. At one point in time, there were 1,600 names before my office that were supposed to be investigated. When we were through done investigating and reviewing, we charged 38 felons with voting that should have not voted. That's 0.00057%. But we had to investigate them all, and then the ones charged, the sentence received, was universally community service. Society has suggested that a person on paper, if you will, who votes isn't committing the crime for which we believe additional incarceration is mandated. For my office, it really cost us about $100,000 in 09, 10, 11, and 12. That's over the elections. Now, we did take some steps for the 2010 election. Hennepin County is a community correction state. We worked with the corrections folks and sent a specific letter to every person on paper saying you can't vote. To be fair about it, we also sent all the folks who went off paper between 2008 and the 2010 election, they could vote. That wasn't cheap either in terms of staff time or printing or mailing. The end result was of 457,000 people voting in non-presidential year in 2010, we ended up with far fewer cases and only 10 cases that we actually charged. But it was expensive. And frankly, Hennepin County ate the dollars to do that just because we could convince our corrections folks it's the right thing to do. What Representative Dean has suggested makes a lot of sense. And I have to admit, having had an opportunity to serve in this body, I didn't often look to North Dakota for enlightenment on statutes. They've got it right there. What this bill does is make it very simple and very direct that all of us can understand it. And that is, if you are convicted as a felon and you are incarcerated, you cannot vote, period. When you are released from incarceration, even if you're on parole, your civil rights to vote can be returned. It's simple, it's direct. To whatever extent that there is lack of faith in our election system, it makes it much more understandable. It saves all of us a lot of money. And furthermore, I must say that if you're convicted of a felony of theft or robbery, capacity to vote is really not directly related there, too. It's kind of an historical anomaly when folks wanted to have, quote, additional penalties. If it makes a difference in $100,000 a year to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, think of the burden if you're in one of the smaller counties that have two or three county attorneys, or maybe only one, or maybe only a part-time. They have to do these. These are a priority. We in the legislature said it was, and it is in. So it's expensive and it's time consuming, and it frankly takes folks away from doing what we'd like or need them to do. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we think we can save money. We can make the system simpler and more direct. We don't think it impacts negatively the criminal justice system. In fact, it makes it better, because we ought not to be enforcing laws that really don't make sense. And relating voting to a felony crime of theft or robbery, et cetera, doesn't make the kind of cogent sense. We can save law enforcement, and prosecutors, and courts money so we can go do our job. So I would strongly urge members of this committee to adopt this, and I would stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ward has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, Representative Dean, thank you for bringing this forward. You know, one of the things that we as legislators and citizens hear often is about our election system and, you know, supposedly the, you know, fraud that we have in the state of Minnesota, which I still don't believe. But, you know, the fact of the matter is this does identify clearly who should and who should not vote if you are labeled as a felon. And I think that would clear up a lot of misconceptions and problems in our election system. Mr. Freeman, though, you mentioned most county election officials, you said all county attorneys are on board with this. Did I hear that correct, Mr. Freeman?
County Attorney Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, that's true, including Don Ryan, your county attorney in Crow Wing County.
Representative Ward.
And actually, I've talked to him, so I know that, Mr. Freeman. I wanted to see what you said with that.
I'm glad I passed the smell test, Representative Ward.
So, also then, Mr. Freeman, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Freeman, you also said that most county election officials are on board. Can you define for us who are the most and who are the least of those?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Ward. County Attorney Freeman.
I'm aware that your chief election official in Brainerd,
Deb Erickson,
is in favor of this. I said that because we haven't had a formal endorsement by the local elections and registrars. I have talked to many of these people as I had the privilege of serving on the governor's task force and election integrity. And those folks represented that most people that worked in elections do. I'm always hesitant to say all. I could say all for county attorneys because we had a meeting and we've endorsed this several times. And I believe Brother Bullmaster would back me up on your examination, Representative Ward.
Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Just one final then. Is, and I have talked to Deb Erickson as well, so I know where she stands on this position. And members, I'd encourage you to always visit with both your county attorney and your county elected officials, because they truly do have the pulse of what is good and what is significant for election reform and where we go with this. So thank you for this.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, I hope you're successful. I think this is for about 8 years I've been trying to take the lead, and the Secretary of State's helped on trying to get sufficient notice out to people, and at that time we couldn't achieve what hopefully you'll achieve this time, but this would really clear up that problem. I do have a question though on the language. Is there some place in statute a definition of incarceration? Because we have so many types of programs now that are diversionary and different things like that. I would guess Kim Thistledew is clearly probably incarceration, but many of these other programs, we even have programs which are putting them with foster parents. What are we looking for more lawsuits unless we have a very clear definition of this? And I guess it would be for probably County Attorney Freeman probably has.
Do you have the answer to that? That.
Mr. Chairman, between Representative Ward and Representative Mullery, I'm paying my dues today. Mr. Chairman, I don't know offhand in the, I believe, 19 volumes of the Minnesota statutes where the definition of incarceration is, but perhaps House Counsel does.
Mr. Diebel, did you? He was searching for it. Can we hold on that?
Sure.
And see if we can get an answer a little? Okay.
Fine.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have one other testifier, too, so I don't want to short-circuit what he has to say, so I'm happy to wait. But, I do have a number of questions. I'm just, as you know, there's no surprise, I'm just not there yet, but I'm open to getting there. I have some concerns, and I have some skepticism about some of this. I was a member of the Election Integrity Task Force as well, and I'm open to different formulations, but let me just, and then this has all been out in the open anyway, share some of the concerns and see what your response is. First of all, as I understand the history of this, Minnesota has at least thought of itself, whether it is or not, as sort of a middle ground. In some states, as you know, once you're convicted of felony, it doesn't matter that your sentence is done. It doesn't matter that you're off paper. You're out for life. In some states like North Dakota, they have the bright line rule saying if you're incarcerated, you can vote. Once you get out, but you're still serving your sentence, you can vote. You know what I'm saying, can't vote and can vote, and that's what your bill is. But Minnesota's been in kind of the middle ground, saying once your full debt to society is paid, and your debt to society is the whole sentence, it's not just the prison part. You're sentenced for a crime, your debt is not paid until the sentence is over. So Minnesota at least thinks of itself as the middle ground. So here are my questions, or the notes of skepticism I have, but I'm open to getting there at some point if depending on the answers. One is, do we really want to say all felons no matter what, no matter how heinous the crime, no matter if it was a repeat crime. I understand the administrative ease. I deal with it in the Elections Committee of elections officials. I have no doubt it will be easier to administer with the bright line rule. I get that. But leaving that aside, are we really saying one size fits all, no matter what, the guy who writes bad checks versus the serial rapist? And I'm being really serious here. Do we need a little bit more nuance? Number two, what about people who violate the conditions of their release? They're out of prison, but they're expected to observe certain norms of behavior. For example, they're expected to be subject to periodic drug tests and to pass those tests. So what about the person who's out of prison but is given a big middle finger to the system? They're not meeting with their PO. They've got dirty urine. They're not playing. Do we reward them with what I consider to be something very special? It is a right, but it's a qualified right. And so that's why I'm not there yet, but I am open-minded to being there. Those are two principal concerns I have, and whether or not we need some nuance there as to types of felons or felonies, the underlying crime, and whether it was a repeat offender, maybe. And number two, do we need some nuance, which I totally understand would be very difficult to administer. I will concede that right now. Mm-hmm. You'd have to get DOC involved, a lot of agencies. Do we need additional nuance in terms of, is the person who's out of prison but still under sentence, are they playing along, or are they not?
Mr. Chairman?
County Attorney Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sutton, I appreciate the thoughtfulness of your questions and the nuanced approach, and I will try to answer the best I can now, but I welcome an ongoing dialogue, and I believe that this bill is successful today. It's going to your committee, so we'll have a chance. First off, in terms of the question, are all felons treated alike? Well, no, all felons aren't treated alike, because you commit the crime of first-degree criminal sexual misconduct, or worse, you commit homicide, you will be in prison for a long time, and your incarceration may well be, if it is first-degree murder, for the rest of your life, which means you will not ever vote. If it's a second-degree intentional, you can do 20, 22, 24 years. During that entire time of incarceration, you cannot vote. And I think this legislature, who has set these sentences with the help of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, has expressed that. I think that takes care of most of that issue to me on the face of it, and I'd be happy to think more deeply on that. Secondly, if you violate the conditions of your release and you're sent back, the language in Representative Dean's bill on line 1.8, if the individual is later incarcerated for the same offense, the individual's civil rights to vote is lost only during the period of incarceration. If they get sent back, they lose the right to vote. What's interesting about this is, I think in the law we try really hard to have bright lines, and you use that phrase, and I appreciated that. The United States Supreme Court does that, so folks know what they can and they cannot do. That's part of the key of the criminal process. That's why you act with such care when you pass criminal statutes. You need to. Folks are entitled to notice. So here we have a very clear line. You're incarcerated, you can't vote. You're not incarcerated, you can vote. So that's a clear. It also, frankly, members, I think it helps with the discussion that we've had ongoing with, frankly, lots of times of lacks of facts about how clear and fair and forthright our election system is. Having now been county attorney for, I can't believe it, 14 years, which is 7 elections, I can tell you firsthand, it's my job to investigate voter fraud. Not just felons voting, but double voting or anything else. And we simply don't have that here. But there is a perception we do, and there's all this discussion about all these felon voters. And frankly, as I told you, 665,000 voted in 2008. 1,600 were referred to us. When you really push it down, there were about 300 valid cases. We can only charge 38. There's very little now. But, you know, we ought to focus, when we see it, with everything we have, of intentionality to commit fraud and impact elections. As somewhat a student, and I'll conclude, Mr. Chairman, of Minnesota elections, I can really only point to one incident that's ever had any real merit about any kind of attempts to impact an election by fraudulent means, and that is simply hearsay and wasn't proof anyway.
Representative Simon, might be a good time to welcome the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. Thanks for coming to the Public Safety Committee. Good questions, Representative Simon, at a timely moment of the committee hearing. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, County Attorney, first of all, I thought County Attorney's their election was for 4 years and not 2 years, so the sub-election cycle, would that be 28 years you've been a County Attorney?
County Attorney Freeman, you
Mr.
can
Chairman,
answer that if you like.
Representative Johnson, I think what I meant to say is I've supervised elections as a County Attorney for 14 years, which is a seven election cycles. Okay. Praise the Lord, I've only had to face the voters three times and perhaps only two times more.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned this is the North Dakota model. Minnesota doesn't use the prison system of the North Dakota model. We use the Minnesota model, which is mostly most of our felons are on paper, and very few actually go to prison. In Minnesota, you can actually get convicted of a felony and never spend a day in jail. So if that person was convicted of that felony, would he under this plan, would he never lose his right to right and privilege to vote?
County Attorney Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, in Minnesota, you are correct. Our system, our entire criminal justice system is vastly different than North Dakota. And I think my earlier comments were I've not often looked to North Dakota for something, but there can be exceptions to every rule. In this state, people also will lose their right to vote when they are in the workhouse or other incarceration situations. What we do in this state is we incarcerate far fewer in our state prison system, but all of the sentences that are less than a year and a day are done on the local level, and that's where, for example, in Hennepin County, our workhouse has folks. The folks are in the workhouse, they can't vote either. When you're incarcerated, you can't vote, whether that incarceration is in a prison system or in a county or local facility.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, County Attorney, so what you're saying, if you're going to be in the county workhouse on a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor offense, under this system, you'd be taking a person's right away to vote, even though by our standards, you only lose it if you're a felony?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think
County Attorney Freeman.
The bill discusses felonies. You can serve time in a local facility for a felony. That's what I was referring to. I'm sorry if I misspoke or there's lack of clarity about misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors. The bill here is discussing folks who have been found guilty of felonies.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, there is quite a difference between the North Dakota model for prisons and Minnesota. As I said, we keep them on, more of them on paper. We have quite a few felonies that never spend a day in the state prison system for that felony offense. A lot of them just do a little or no time in the county facility. In North Dakota, they lock theirs up for most of their sentence, I believe. When they do get out, they've served their time. In Minnesota, a good portion of their time is on paper. It concerns me that we could actually have convicted felons never lose their right to vote as part of a sentence that is established throughout this country. You commit a felony, you lose your right to vote. In some states, it's their entire life. Some states, not their whole time, but they complete their sentence.
Is that a comment, Representative? Did you have a question for the County Attorney?
No, I guess that was more of a comment.
Okay, very good. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, County Attorney Freeman. I spoke with Representative Dean yesterday about this bill, and County Attorney Freeman, your office did call. I spent a good part of last night thinking about this, and I realize it's very important that returning felons become productive members of our society, and voting correctly is one of those one of those steps to become productive in society. But just because it's difficult to enforce a law, just because we're spending money to enforce this, I don't think is reason enough to change this law. I've heard testimony to the fact that County Attorney Freeman, what was it, $100,000 or more you're spending to do these investigations? And you know what? That's a cost of doing business. That's a cost of doing business and enforcing the laws. And I'm sure if we looked at budgets and things, we'd find that we spend a lot of money enforcing, probably more money enforcing some other laws that might be similar. And just because felons happen to be ignorant of the law once they're doing their probation or whatever and vote, I was always taught that ignorance of the law is no excuse. So I feel that a sentence is a sentence, and saving money, and just because it's difficult to enforce, maybe isn't a good reason for that right now. And I share Representative Johnson's feelings about the fact that some felons, and we know that for a fact, that they never spend a day in jail. So I guess my question is to Representative Dean, mm-hmm. is have you really looked at other ways that we could educate the felons that are being released, going off paper, and all that, where this problem would not occur?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, I have. There have been many bills in the past that have brought forward different ideas on how to do what's called felony voter notification and other types of things. There are many complications associated with that. We're still going to have those incidences where individuals don't know or wrongly know at their right to vote. And we've been spending a lot of time talking about the county attorney's point of view and sort of that ease of transition from an individual leaving incarceration to being out in the public. And I do have another testifier, and as the clock begins to tick, I want to make sure that we have an opportunity to get him up to speak, and then I'd also like to take a couple minutes to tell you why I brought this bill forward.
We have plenty of time, Representative Dean.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Uglum. Chair. That's fine. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I strongly support this proposal. I think that it's going in the right direction, but I have a question, and just to make sure you look at it in the law, we just changed the statute not that long ago that require election judges, when you get ready to sign, to say if you're a felon, you don't sign this because it's a crime if you sign this if you're not eligible to vote. You might need to look at if we need to change that notification based on this statute, and it doesn't take care of it in the bill. But I'm a strong supporter. I think you've come a long way. And members, just so you know, some states even allow felons who are in custody, in prison, to vote while they're in prison, and you see long lines of prisoners, you know, on TV occasionally, waiting their turn to vote. And so Minnesotans, even if they re-implement this, are still in the middle. So I strongly encourage you to support the bill.
Representative Mullery, were you back on, or did you? I can't remember what your question was.
Now I remember. I was just going to make a quick comment. I'm still waiting for the incarceration answer because I really think that's a confusion. But I was just going to say that with regard to some comments, I hope that we're not going to deny somebody voting because they have a dirty urine or something like that. If they're not bad enough on violation to be sent back, I don't think that should be.
Okay, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, I just wanted to say thank you for your comments. I generally appreciate the way you approach legislation, and I'm glad that it's going to your committee because I think you had some very thoughtful questions. County Attorney Freeman, it appears to me that you do have a problem in the standpoint of investigating these, and it is very time-consuming. But it seems to me that maybe we're looking for for a wrong solution. I'm with Representative Simon from the standpoint of this is a debt. This is a debt to society. You've committed a crime. I don't think any of the victims out there would see this as a very favorable legislation when, generally speaking, only about two-thirds of that sentence is filled and then they're released. So I think that's a major concern of mine. One of the things that, you know, heaven forbid we look at the election process, and it seems to me if we went to something, I'm just going to throw out a wild idea of an ID or something that when these people got out, they would have to show an ID. You wouldn't have to investigate anything because right at the election bid, there would be an ID that either said you could or you couldn't vote. So it was a wild idea, Mr. Chair, but I guess I do have some concerns, and I'm glad that we'll be asking these questions in Representative Simon's committee. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have anything else you want to say, County Attorney Freeman?
No, okay.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
You.
If you could just hang here, though, before we leave. Okay. Mr. Hasse? Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. My name is Mark Hasse. I'm the Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice, a Minneapolis-based community organization. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which is a coalition of over 50 organizations that support this reform. Those organizations range from criminal justice-related organizations like mine to Goodwill Easter Seals that work with these individuals in the community to faith-based organizations like the Minnesota Catholic Conference and the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. That's who I am. I'm going to give you some other reasons to support this bill that didn't come up earlier, and I hope they'll address some of these questions, as well as do a little bit of clarifying. First, I would just add to County Attorney Freeman's testimony that at the Council on Crime and Justice, we have a criminal records information line, and we receive funding to try and help educate people about their voting rights. And we hear from people over and over and over again. I can't give you statistics because it's not tracked, but the people who think they can't vote when they legally can. We had to take one case all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court this last election cycle because the law says they can vote, but probation officers, attorneys, and people didn't understand if they could vote or not. And so there's, anecdotally, there's far, far more people not voting because of the confusion in these laws than those that either accidentally or maybe in some cases even intentionally vote. But I would put forth that we can never have a perfect fraud-free system. With that, I think first I'd like to ask you to consider how important is voting to you. Representative Simon, you said it's a right with some qualifications. I agree. I think every right we have has some qualifications. But to me, I think this is maybe the most fundamental right. I'll just, not trying to be political here, but I think, you know, compare it to the Second Amendment. Is it more important that you can bear arms or that you can vote and put people in office or take them out of office when they don't uphold the Constitution? I think this is the most fundamental right. Going from that, I think we have to look at this issue of what's a felony and who are these people and whose rights have been taken away over time. Professor Chris Eugen, a sociologist at the University of Minnesota, has done a lot of national research on this, and he's looked at the numbers. And the issue, one issue here is that what used to be a felony is not the same as what a felony is now. When the Constitution was written, felonies were very, very, very the most serious offenses. Just to add the statistics here, since 1982, the percentage of our voting age population that is currently disenfranchised as a result of a felony conviction has increased by over 400%. The percentage of our population in that those 30 years alone has increased over 400%. Now, why is that? Because over time, we've become more punitive. Not you all sitting here, maybe some of you, but others in the past have created these laws. Many of them are drug laws. This is a big percentage of this. That have put people, that have convicted people of a felony. Yes, we're known for being one of, Representative Johnson, this is sort of towards your question, for being a state that uses incarceration very judiciously. And I think that's a good policy. I think when people are in the community, they can be more successful and are less likely to reoffend. But at the same time, what we've done under our sentencing guidelines is we've been very liberal in our use of probation and felony convictions, especially when it comes to drug laws. We have some of the harshest, longest drug sentences in the country. They're now longer than Texas. No, they don't go to jail on the first offense. In some cases, they don't go to prison on the second offense. But we know people, and I could get you the numbers. I'm not going to read them off here, but on drug offenses that have 30-year sentences, probation sentences. So that's the criminalization issue. And, you know, and another statistic, in 1982, there were about 5,000 people convicted of a felony in Minnesota. In 2010, I think it was, there were about 15,000. So there again, the numbers are tripling over these years. And I do think that there's a legitimate argument that this is part of the punishment. If somebody's violated the, you know, what we've set up as a society, our laws, and they should be punished, and in some cases taking away this fundamental right is appropriate. This bill doesn't stop that. If you go to jail, if we've decided as a community that you should do prison time, be in prison or be in jail, your right is taken away during that time. And that's to your question, Representative Simon, I think, you know, we can quibble about how serious some of these offenses are when people are in the community, but, you know, I would just go back to Hennepin County Attorney Freeman's testimony that it gets very complicated when we try to do that outside of this type of thing. So, I would put forth that if it's serious enough for somebody to be in jail or prison, let's take away the right to vote. I would be remiss if although this affects every citizen, you know, many people across the state here of all races and backgrounds, and more white people are disenfranchised as a result of these laws, more people in rural communities by the numbers, but there is a disparate racial impact here. And that's because of other things, history, the way we enforce and the laws we create. I'm looking for the numbers here. In 2007, almost 17%, nearly one in five of otherwise eligible voting age African-American males were disenfranchised. The percentage for white males, or whites and white males, is I believe it's roughly 2-3%. Now, one other cost I want to mention, not a financial cost, is the cost to families and communities and generations. What kind of message does it send a young person when their parent can't vote? I'll just leave it there. There's people in the audience that can testify to that much better than I can, but I think we have to think about the message we're sending about engaging positively in our community and these fundamental rights. Finally, I just want to say that, and I think County Attorney Freeman touched on this, this is a pro-social positive public safety. This is the Public Safety Committee. It's hard to get the research on this to show the causation, but some research by Professor Eugen has shown that people who can vote are less likely to recidivate. Just it makes sense that if people are going to engage, if we want people to move on from offending, we want them to engage in what the corrections field calls pro-social activities. In fact, that's why the Minnesota Corrections Association, an association of over 500 corrections professionals, has this bill, this change in their legislative agenda. The American Association of Corrections and Parole Officers supports this change. The League of Women Voters is very supportive on this. They have representatives here in the audience and the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I'm wrapping it up here. I know this is probably the longest I've testified on any bill yet this session. I wanted to just list there's been questions and comments about the states that do this and don't do that and what they do. I've got a list here. We probably should have had it ready for the committee. I'm sorry we didn't. As Representative Hillstrom said, two states never take away the right. That's Maine and Vermont. In Europe, the taking away the right to vote for incarceration has been they hold that to be a violation of human rights. I know Europe is not, you know, always the best, the model everybody wants to look at. So those that do the Dakota model, North Dakota model, there's 13 states: Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Utah. Those are the states that we would join along with North Dakota if we change this, and I strongly ask you to support this bill. Thank you
for your testimony, and now you have four members that have questions of you. Before we do that, can I have a motion, before we run out of time here, to approve the minutes of March 5th and March 6th?
So moved, Mr.
Representative Rosenthal makes that motion. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. excuse me, Representative Schoen, did you have a question or comment? Or not yet?
The fire, so I'd be, mine's going to be for
attorney agreement. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ray, Representative. I've been kind of processing our conversation last night when you asked me to really kind of look into this and think about this issue. And I've really been mulling this over, and I wanted to wait to hear the whole story. I'm still waiting. We've had some excellent testimony. We've had some statistics. We've had some excellent examples. But the one part of the equation that we have yet to hear from are victims. I have yet to hear from a victim's family of someone whose mother or father has been murdered, or someone whose child has been abducted, or someone whose wife has been raped, to sit here and say, you know what, this individual did this to my family, and I think they're out of prison, but I think that they should have the right to vote. We haven't heard from victims yet. And until I hear from victims of felonies, because we're concentrating on one side of this equation that says let's get these people reintegrated into society, let's get them productive, let's get this moving. But yet we haven't heard of anyone who has been a victim of a felony who has come forward and attested to this. I would like to hear from that. I would like to also say that this when we go through the whole sentencing program, are there not plea bargains?
Is that a question?
That's
a question to anyone that wants to answer this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger, yes, I believe there are plea bargains.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you've got five different felons all convicted of the same crime, potentially. All five could get different prison sentences depending on their plea bargain and depending on their case. So we're trying to make this kind of cut and dry, black and white, as far as yes or no. I can't support this. We haven't heard from any victims yet. And I think that if we were to bring victims and family members and parents and children in here of people who've been on the receiving end of these heinous felonies, I think we'd be hearing a different story. So I just wanted to mention that. And then also I just want to echo what Mr. Hasse said. I think this would be a perfect vehicle to add an amendment. If we're going to restore their right to vote, then would we also be restoring their right to own firearms?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, as Representative Neuberg started, I'd like to hear from a victim of somebody that's committed a felony. I have a perfect example that I can use. I've been in law enforcement for over 27 years. I've arrested many individuals on felonies. In fact, yesterday, one of the persons that I've arrested numerous times on felonies was in the news again. He's on long-term probation because of numerous offenses. That's why he's on long-term probation, because of the large number of offenses he's committed. Up in St. Louis County, yesterday they issued an arrest warrant for 13 felony violations, with the most serious one, a first-degree sexual assault. Should this person still be able to vote? I don't believe so. I've arrested this person leaving my parents' driveway when I was just happened to be driving by their house while I was working. And I ended up talking to him. The only reason he didn't commit the burglary that time is he saw the squad car, so he decided to leave. But I recognized him and knew his driver's license was revoked. This person should not be able to vote as soon as he gets out of prison. He should serve his time. Earlier we heard things about the term the bright lines of where you can and can't vote. We have them now. It's called when they're off paper. And I believe that we need to stay that way.
Thank you. Just a quick announcement before, because we're going to vote in a few minutes here. I want to give Representative Dean the final moment, final few minutes. We will be meeting, I hope you're flexible next week. I want to hear as many bills as we possibly can. We will be meeting during our regular time, maybe an evening session, and on Friday of next week, bill deadline. So, and I'll coordinate that with Representative Cornish as we figure this all out. So, Representative Kelly, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hussey, I really do have a clarifying question because I want to understand what you're asking of us. I understood County Attorney Freeman and his ask and his reasoning and justification, and that was pretty clear. But on the one hand, you say, I mean, you talk about the right to vote as being one of the most fundamental rights we have, and I agree with you. But in that vein, that is the punishment that we currently have. So are you asking us to simply diminish our punishment, diminish the amount of debt that this individual owes to society simply for that reason? I guess I really want you to clarify what you're asking and why you're asking it.
Mr. Hussey, briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, another day I'd like to ask to have some of those sentences reduced. Today we're asking about addressing the fact that we've created too long of sentences for too many people. And I'm just going to take 15 to 20 seconds to respond to a couple of other things on the firearms rights. My answer to Representative Neuberger would be, in some cases, and Representative Cornish and I have suggested this to him, drug offenses should not take away your right to carry a firearm. I'm a hunter. I object to that. So I think there's some reasonableness that has to be found there. And then the victims, I do have to address the victims because this term gets thrown around a lot. And a lot of people are victimized, and you can bring up a line of victims here, and they're all going to say different things. Mary Johnson from the North Side, her son was killed, murdered by a young man who she's now taken into her home, basically adopted as a child. She would say one thing, and somebody else would say another. Kelly Moeller, the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime of Victims, that's a group of victims groups, which the Council on Crime and Justice is part of, did a survey, informal survey she presented to the task force, and she found that victims were sort of half and half on this. And I think she could come to a future committee and present those findings. So thank you for your
time.
Thank
you. Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted County Attorney Freeman just to help me get past one point, and I think I'm there, but it's when you're on paper, and this is what my hang-up has been from the beginning, is that when you're on probation or parole, that's part of the sentence, and I see what you're doing, and I think it's probably the right direction, but just help me get over that hump, County Attorney Freeman.
County Attorney Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Tim Schoen, let me try, but I want to be respectful of the time. You know, society sets penalties, and this legislature is the one who sets the penalties. And the judges within the confines of those determine how long the person's going to be incarcerated and what kind of the conditions of parole are going to be. There are cases in which we ask for much longer parole because we want to have a hold over that person. But part of it, the struggle I understand this committee needs to go through is how does the penalty of not being able to vote relate to the penalty for the underlying crime that they committed. Okay, the more serious the crime, the longer the period of incarceration, the longer their time they're not going to be able to vote. That's pretty clear. At least that's what we're asking. But the question is, for the election system and for the fairness in elections, the clarity of elections, how important is it to deny people who are reintegrating into society their right to vote? That, you know, is a fundamental policy question, and good people can disagree. From us on our side, to be able to make the election system clear, cleaner, neater, more straightforward, and frankly, to save a lot of money that I'd rather spend ferreting out really serious crime than going after folks who mistakenly vote when they're not supposed to vote.
County Attorney Freeman, can you answer the question? And I'm not sure you're answering it.
I thought it was.
Actually, Mr. Chair, that helps me. I get where he's coming from, and I'll just say this, that this is probably the bill that I actually have tossed and turned about the most, and I do plan to support it now that it's I've arrived there. I was not in the beginning, but thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment for Mr. Haas and the testifying is that if you're looking for conservative votes as you move through this process, do not compare giving felons back their rights to vote with the Second Amendment, because the Second Amendment is much more important, and it protects all the other amendments. Plus, you've raised the red flag now with the DFL counterparts, because they know this is a perfect vehicle for us to attach an amendment for restoration, it's going to be hard to keep that amendment off of there. It's going to be germane restoration of gun rights along with rights to vote. So you did quite a bit of damage to that bill today, I think.
Representative Dean, you have the final few minutes here to make your closing argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. One of the reasons that I've brought this forward is I don't believe that taking away the right to vote to an individual increases public safety at all. As a matter of fact, I think it hinders public safety. An individual that has the right to vote, that's out in society, feels that they're a part of society. I want to address a couple comments relative to victims. I've been a victim of a burglary myself, and I don't see any reason why that young man that was in my house should not have his right to vote. I want him to have a voice in society. I want him to be engaged. I want him to move forward. Beyond that, I myself in 1976 committed a burglary from which I did some time. I went through paper. I got off paper. And I'll tell you, voting made me feel like I was part of society. I'll tell you right now that while I was on paper, voting wasn't something that kept me straight and narrow. There were many other factors that came in. A motivating factor for me was not, God, I need to get through paper so that I can vote again. That wasn't it. It was individuals and myself felt a part of the community. And I think that that's important. You know, I'll just conclude by saying that the individual that is out in society and is working to rebuild their lives, I don't think we should be telling them that we don't value them and that they don't have a right to vote and participate in our system. I think that it's very fundamental to an individual and their engagement in society and in our election system. And I just urge you to support this. I think it's a good bill. I'd like to see it move forward. I'd like to have those discussions and would welcome your support.
Okay, very good. Any further discussion? I might note it's going to elections, and it also, I think, has to go to state government finance because there's a fiscal note attached to it to the Secretary of State's office. So with that, Representative, I will renew my motion that House File 491 pass and be referred to the Committee on Elections. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. We're adjourned.